Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to talk now about revolutions, technological revolutions to be precise. Here's how Paul Mantu describes one such revolution. Quote, "It is precisely the expansion of undeveloped forces, the sudden growth and blossoming of seeds which had for years lain hidden or asleep."
Mantu was a 19th century historian, and in that quotation, he's describing the Industrial Revolution that swept with steam and soot from London to Lawrence, Massachusetts, and beyond, of course. But Mantu's words might as well describe the digital revolution we're living in today, where access to technology expands previously undeveloped forces, and massive computing power leads to sudden growth and blossoming of seeds around the world.
Major advances in machine technology sparked both the industrial and digital revolutions. But our next guests say that the digital transformation we're experiencing is bigger, full of more potential and peril for billions of people. They say we're living in the second machine age.
That is the title of Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee's new book. Brynjolfsson and McAfee are co-founders of MIT's new initiative on the digital economy, and their book is The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. A little later tonight, I'll be speaking with them both at a Harvard bookstore event at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, but they are here with us at Radio Boston now. Eric and Andrew, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Meghna.
Good to be here.
Okay. So your book title includes the subtitle, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Why brilliant? What is the defining feature of this second machine age that you see, you believe we're living in?
Well, we've just been amazed by the way the technology is advancing. I mean, even just last night at the Super Bowl, there was that ad, you may remember it, where the dad was trying to protect his kid from everything. And then the last scene, it was the car that jammed on the brakes in time to rescue right. the family. Andy and I experienced a little version of that a couple summers ago. We were driving down Route 101.
In the Google car.
In the Google car, no human driver. The car in front of us on Route 101, a highway, came to a complete dead stop. And we both kind of gripped the seat as we were hoping, praying that this Google car would know to stop. And we're here today, luckily, because it did come to a complete stop. But that's sort of one small example of, you could call it science fiction technologies changing how cars drive. We talk to our machines now, and we take them out of our pocket, and we talk to them in ordinary language, and they understand us and follow our instructions.
But this is the underlying premise, though, that we're living in a world of not necessarily self-aware, sentient machines, but thinking machines now, right?
And the reason we use the word brilliant in our subtitle was the other words are kind of used up. We've got smart, we've got intelligent, we've been using these things. So we tried to think of a different word to describe the nature of these technologies that we're seeing. We settled on brilliant for two reasons. One is it conveys the fact that these things seem to be doing really advanced things, really smart things. The second sense is that Eric and I think this is brilliant in the way that the English describe it. This is really cool, fantastic stuff.
Okay. So I want to talk in a moment about what lessons and comparisons we can draw from the earlier machine age that humanity
sure.
experienced. But before we do that, I mean, describe to me what it is, what was in the cultural, the technological, the economic stew that brought us to this second machine age, because really the transformation has been so rapid. I mean, I think to myself of, you know, like the technology that's in my iPhone, and it is orders of magnitude more sophisticated than the technology that put men on the moon a mere 50 years ago.
Our favorite factoid on that one, by one estimate, the amount of processing power that you have in the greeting card that you open up and it plays a tune, it plays happy birthday for you, by one estimate, that's more processing power than the Allied forces had in World War II. So this progress is just astonishing. Meghna, you had that amazing quote from a historian that's to start this off. We haven't come across this one, but we came across a similar one from mm-hmm. Hemingway, mm-hmm. who describes how a person goes broke. And he says it's gradually and then suddenly. And that characterizes the kind of progress that we're seeing, where there is this kind of low-level, incremental, nothing to see here, move along progress going on. Then all of a sudden, holy Toledo, and we've got phones that talk back to us and cars that drive themselves.
And part of the underlying change there is the exponential function. It's been said by Albert Bartlett that the greatest failing of the human mind is the inability to understand the exponential function. And I have to say, both Andy and I have been guilty of that at different times. We try to make it our business to keep up with these technologies, but they keep astonishing us as well.
Right. So the capacity of the technology, the literal computational capacity the technology has exploded. But in concert with that, there's more, though. There's more
That's only part of it.
But it's a really important part. And you say that it's exploded, which is true. There's twice as much of it as there was 18 or 24 months ago. But that's been true as long as we've had computers.
Okay.
So this Moore's Law, I think of it as a drumbeat in the background of the economy. And after a while, you've got enough accumulated power that you can do these astonishing things, like teach a computer to play Jeopardy better than anybody else.
But I think what fascinated me about what you talk about, what you point out in your book, is that it's the emergent properties of all this computational power. One is that we now have more information at the tips of our fingers than ever before.
That's exactly right. We have a whole chapter on Moore's Law and exponential improvement, but that's only one of the three big trends. A second one that we talk about is the digitization of everything. And a lot of people refer to big data. And data is the lifeblood of science and progress. When you can measure things, when you can understand what's happening, you can make much faster progress. And one of the reasons we've seen breakthroughs in so many of those areas we just mentioned is that just throwing tons and tons of data at the problem, and problems that used to be hard turn out to be easy if you throw enough data at them. And the third big change that we call combinatorics, recombinant innovation, there's this mistaken idea that innovations get used up, and some people have said, well, all the great innovations are in our past. The low-hanging fruit has been plucked. We don't see it that way. In fact, a better way to think about innovations is as building blocks that you can put together, and the more innovations that exist, the more new innovations you can create by combining and recombining the old ones.
Andy, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, on this idea of oceans of digital data, some of our favorite colleagues in computer science and AI, when we ask them, how are you making progress on these really tough problems, recognizing objects in photos, diagnosing diseases, these kinds of things, they say, look, for a long time, we've had theories about how you do this. And our theory said, assume you had a really, really huge amount of data. We don't have to assume that anymore. We've got the data sandboxes to play in. And thanks to the fact that, you know, our phones spit out data all the time, those sandboxes are huge and getting huger.
Yeah. So I did promise that we will hear a little bit about lessons learned from the Industrial Revolution. But before we leave sort of this, what are we talking about when we talk about the second machine age? I'd love for you to just spend a minute giving us an example, one that a lot of people might have some familiarity with, and that is Watson, IBM's supercomputer, which, you know, if you don't know what it's doing now, it was on Jeopardy and it won. So, I mean, it's one of those thinking machines that people seem to point to as evidence of this second machine age.
Well, we brought Watson to MIT as well. Dave Ferrucci and his team, we invited them to play against three of our smartest MIT students. And sad to say, the MIT students lost and lost badly. Perhaps not surprisingly, the questions that really did him in were some sports questions, so it's something we have to work on our curriculum.
That may not have been there.
Cliche sprung to life.
Watson had no problem with those. But, of course, you know, IBM didn't just build Watson to embarrass MIT students or win money on a game show. That same technology is diagnosing diseases. It's helping lawyers make decisions. It's answering questions in call centers. It's helping with investment advice. Basically, it's a very general question answering machine.
And it's a particularly amazing one to us because I'm going to oversimplify a lot. What the IBM team did was shovel in a ridiculously large amount of information. So they gave them a copy of Wikipedia. They fed them daily newspapers. They just gave them all kinds of digital data. And then their cleverness was to teach Watson to draw correct inferences from that huge pool of pretty unstructured information so that when you asked Watson a question about sports, about history, about science, it could reach in there and pluck out the correct answer very accurately and quicker than the best human Jeopardy players.
One of the funny mistakes they made was they let Watson surf the internet unsupervised, and the next day it started using profanity in the answers to some of its questions.
So they had to take the Urban Dictionary out of the Watson database.
Just goes to show you're only as good as the information you have.
Watson's only 7 years old, so you got to be careful.
Yeah, we're talking about computational intelligence, not emotional intelligence necessarily. Listeners, I'm speaking with Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee. They're co-founders of MIT's new initiative on the digital economy and co-authors of the new book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Eric and Andrew, let's talk about the first machine age. Let's talk about lessons learned and the difference between the transformation humanity experienced with the industrial age versus the transformation we're experiencing now. What's the core difference, first of all, between the industrial age and the second machine age that you're talking about?
The core difference is that the first industrial revolution was about overcoming the limitations of our muscle power and the muscle power of the domestic animals that we had. And when we did that, it honestly put humanity on a completely different trajectory. If you try to graph human history, you'll learn there was one big event, and it was spurred by the Industrial Revolution. What's going on now, and the reason Eric and I think we're in a second machine age, is we are overcoming the limitations of our individual minds by things like artificial intelligence and by developments like internetworking. A lot of the world's people now, and basically all the world's people in a few more years, these are allowing us to overcome the limitations of our individual minds to at least as great an extent. The question that we kind of asked ourselves and that we ask in the book, how can this not be as big a deal as overcoming the limitations of our muscles?
If not bigger.
And when we think it is a huge deal in terms of how it's affecting the economy and turning that inflection point. But there's also some important differences. When you have a machine that overcomes the limitations of our muscles, you still need a brain to control what decisions are going to be made, how are you going to use all that physical power. The new machines that are augmenting our cognitive capabilities, it's not always as clear whether they're going to be substitutes or complements for humans.
Okay.
And in the first Industrial Revolution, there was a lot of worrying by some pretty well-informed people that this was going to put tons of people out of work permanently. We started to hear this phrase, technological unemployment. It didn't happen. The Industrial Revolution was eventually great news for the working man. The question that Eric and I wrestle with and that our colleagues wrestle with is, are we seeing the same movie again now, or are we seeing a different movie?
Right. Well, speaking of movies now, suddenly Terminator and The Matrix are floating through my head, but that's sort of the dystopian future, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But I did want to ask you about one thing, because you mentioned economics and the overall impact on humanity that the Industrial Revolution brought. Because on the one hand, productivity went up, and we had the advent of all sorts of some of that physical labor was backbreaking that human beings had to do.
Yeah, a lot of it
right?
was. The conditions were terrible.
Yeah, and so in the long run, it did actually, as you mentioned, it increased the quality of life for vast numbers of people.
Absolutely.
But at a cost at that time for other people.
It was very uneven. And this is sort
and,
of
and
a,
the transition was long and painful for some folk. Let's not minimize that.
Yeah, it's sort of a dirty secret of economics that while technology certainly grows the economic pie and creates vastly more wealth, in fact, today we're at record levels of wealth, $77 trillion, there's no economic law that says everyone's going to benefit evenly or even at all. Some people could be made worse off. And there were certainly people back in the 1800s who were made worse off. The Luddites wanted to smash the machines because they were losing their jobs, and they were, for a time, made worse off. And that happens almost with every technology that comes along. It creates jobs and opportunity, but it also destroys jobs and opportunity for other people.
Isn't that problem just so much more exacerbated by the nature of this second machine age that we're in?
We kind of believe so. We believe that's a very real possibility. And some of the most interesting discussions we have these days are with our really sharp colleagues in computer science, robotics, artificial intelligence, economics, to say, how big a difference is this time? Are we seeing some new chapter? And if so, how new?
And the data suggests that there are some important differences. While productivity, employment, median income all kind of rose closely in tandem for most of the 20th century, starting around the late 80s, early 1990s, they started diverging. Productivity and overall income has continued to grow sharply, but employment has leveled off, and as I mentioned earlier, median income has stagnated, so it's not coupled the way it used to be.
So Eric and I call this the great decoupling. There are some economic statistics we care a great deal about, output and productivity, that have continued on a pretty healthy trajectory. There are other ones we care about, mainly having to do with the labor force, median income, social mobility, things like that, that are not on a healthy trajectory. So to echo what Eric said, the pie is clearly getting bigger, but there are issues about how we're slicing it up.
So let me ask you a little bit more about that. And I don't know if this is an awkward comparison or not, but I think of modern day Silicon Valley, one of the epicenters of the second machine age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the innovations coming out of there are astounding, but it is one of the most income in unequal places in the country. I mean, and...
No, that's exactly right. And that is a perfect example. You know, many of these technologies, we mentioned digitization as one of the big forces. Well, digitization leads to some unusual, weird, and wonderful economics. When you have something that's digitized, you can make a copy of it for virtually zero cost. And that copy is a perfect replica of the original, and you can transmit it anywhere in the world instantaneously. Now, free, perfect, and instant are characteristics that haven't characterized goods and services in the past, but they also lead to winner-take-all economics in many markets, where whoever makes that first copy, and if it's a good one, that's the one people want to buy. They want to buy the best product. They don't want to buy the thousandth best or even the third best product. And so usually in digital markets, you tend to get a lot of concentration, winner-take-all or winner-take-all markets. That's great for the people who produce those products. It's also, let me emphasize, great for consumers. They get wonderful products at very low cost. But if you happen to be one of the people who is competing with that, you may have a really hard time.
And we were out in Silicon Valley last week, and the conversation out there is really interesting because there's this growing set of voices that are kind of questioning technology or in some cases downright hostile to it. And we understand where they're coming from. The changes in inequality and mobility are very worrying, but we think they've identified the wrong fix, which is in some cases to try to slow down or halt the march of technology. What Eric and I advocate instead, please let technology race ahead, but let's modify our organizations and our institutions and our policies to try to keep up with it. Let's not try to tamp down technology. Terrible idea.
Well, if not impossible, right?
And probably impossible. But you could imagine a technology Politburo. It's really one of my deepest, darkest nightmares.
But let's talk specifically about these recommendations that you make in the book. I mean, let's begin with policy. What kind of, let's say, national or even international level policy might you suggest to smooth the transition into this second machine?
We've got two chapters on policy recommendations, one more short term and one a little bit longer term. And the short term is basically just a summary of a good Econ 101 textbook, because even though the great decoupling is going on, we have not totally divorced economic growth from employment growth. So the right recipe in the short term, if you want jobs and wages to bounce back, grow the economy. And the Econ 101 textbook is a great way to get that done. And we deal with things like educational reform, like making a welcoming environment for entrepreneurship, immigration reform, doubling down and fixing our country's infrastructure.
Let me interject. I have to. And Eric, maybe I'll throw this to you. Is that enough? Because these are the same policy prescriptions we've heard to solve any problem that's ailing. You know, let's keep it to the United States now.
It's not necessarily enough, but it's a start. And let me just underscore the importance of the education one. It's been actually called America's best idea, which is mass universal education. And that was probably the number one reason that we not just survived, but thrived through the first machine age. Inequality has been called a race between technology and education. And historically, we've made sure we came out on top on that race. But it's not going to be enough to just double down on the old policies. We're going to have to reinvent education.
Now, one place where you get delightfully wonky, because I love compelling
you
wonkiness.
You like the policy chapters.
Yeah. Well, it's when you talk about taxes.
Yes.
And an instrument that it might serve
yes.
as.
So that's in our longer-term recommendations chapter. After you get done with the Econ 101 textbook, in the longer term, one of the most fundamental insights of economics is tax the stuff you want to see less of and subsidize the stuff you want to see more of. Well, we tax labor like crazy in the country. 80% of federal revenue comes from income and payroll taxes. So if you take that insight and we are trying to inject work and labor back into the economy, we're getting a little bit backward, and there are some things we can do. They sound like crazy socialist ideas right now, the idea of a negative income tax or a guaranteed basic income, but they've been advocated by noted pinkos like Milton Friedman.
Right. And we want to go beyond just redistributing money, because in the research for this book, we looked at what some of the stuff that Robert Putnam had said, and there's this great quote actually going back to Voltaire, who said, "Work solves three great evils, boredom, vice, and need." And actually, the easiest one of those to address is the need one. But work also gives people a sense of meaning. And one of the reasons that we favor not simply a redistribution, but something like an expanded earned income tax credit, is that it really encourages people to work more.
Absolutely.
It subsidizes people to work, not just to get money. And if we expanded that dramatically, I think it would lead to more people working, and that would solve all three of those evils.
You know, yep. In the last couple minutes that we have here, I just sort of made a half-joking throwaway remark about the Terminator and the Matrix when it comes to the rise of the machines. But behind that, I am not a Luddite. I am not a technophobe. I feel like most of the time I'm pretty bullish about the future.
All right.
But there's something fundamental about how you define the second machine age that does give me a little bit of pause. And that is, I mean, Eric, you said it. We're not sure if we're talking about complements or replacements to human intelligence. I mean, are you optimistic about the fact that we don't know we don't know which way it's going to go yet?
We're neither wild-eyed optimists, nor are we dystopians about it. And what we want to try and emphasize in the last book is that this technology is more powerful than what we've seen before. The possibilities are greater. And the freedom that we have to choose our future is much greater than it was in the past. But with that comes a lot of responsibility. There is no automatic guarantee that this is going to pan out in a happy way.
Or
no guarantee that it's going to be dystopian. And we see both groups, and we think they both kind of make the same mistake. The people who are the happy utopians, hey, don't worry about it, guys. Just chill out. It's all going to work out. Or the ones who say, we're doomed. There's nothing we can do. Andy and I call ourselves mindful optimists. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should underscore the word mindful, which means that we have to pay attention to what's going on and take actions to address that. The technology is going to advance. That part is easy to predict. But our responses in terms of our own individual skills, organizations, our policies, depend on understanding those implications. And it's on us. It's our responsibility to step up to that huge change.
Eric just underscored the mindful part. Let me underscore the optimistic part. The problem we are not going to face in the future, and this is really important to keep in mind, the problem we're not going to face is the problem of not enough to go around. If we blow that, shame on us.
Well, Andrew McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson are the co-founders of MIT's new initiative on the digital economy. They are mindful optimists.
That's right.
Yep.
I think I'm going to make that a mantra for myself, being a mindful optimist about the future. They're co-authors of the new book, The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. I'll be talking with them in just a couple hours at the Brattle Theater at a Harvard Bookstore event. Come on over to Cambridge, because there's
over
a lot more to discuss.
We want to talk.
6 o'clock.
Continue
We'd love
the
to hear from you.
Thanks so much for joining us here today.
Meghna, thank you.
Real pleasure.
Listeners, stay with us, because coming up, we'll talk about the spiritual side of brewing. So from machines to brewing, a look inside America's first Trappist brewery right here in Spencer, Massachusetts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.